government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a special Law Day episode of the Federalist Society Free Lunch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our bi-weekly newsletter for alerts about new content and events, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn to track our progress. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. To celebrate Law Day, a day President Dwight D. Eisenhower designated as a time to annually reflect on the role of law in the foundation of the country and to recognize its importance for society, our Free Lunch Podcast today questions whether we're seeing the beginning of the end for the Chevron doctrine. We ask this question now because last month, Arizona became the first state in the union to pass a law to eliminate Chevron-like deference in its state courts. So, this program will explore this new law, discuss how it might change state agency rulemaking, enforcement, and accountability, and whether this law can serve as a model for the rest of the country and the federal government to address concerns regarding judicial bias and other constitutional issues. I'm pleased to welcome two guests to our program today, Professor Philip Hamburger and Attorney Jonathan Riches. Philip Hamburger is the Maurice and Hilda Friedman Professor of Law at Columbia Law School, where he teaches constitutional law and its history. He is also president of the New Civil Liberties Alliance, a civil rights organization that litigates against the administrative state and its threat to constitutional rights. You can find out more at NCLA, New Civil Liberties Alliance, legal.org. Professor Hamburger's books are Liberal Suppression, Section 501c3 and the Taxation of Speech, The Administrative Threat, Is Administrative Law Unlawful, Law and Judicial Duty, and Separation of Church and State. Among his recent articles is Chevron Bias in the George Washington Law Review 2016, which explains how Chevron violates due process rights. Before Columbia Law, Professor Hamburger was the John P. Wilson Professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he has served on the board of directors of the American Society for Legal History. He has twice received the Sutherland Prize and has been awarded the Henry Paolucci Walter Batchett Book Award, the Hayek Book Prize, and the Bradley Prize. Jonathan Riches is the Director of National Litigation for the Goldwater Institute's Scharf Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation and General Counsel for the Institute. John litigates in federal and state trial and appellate courts in the areas of economic liberty, taxpayer rights, public union and pension reform, government transparency, free speech, and school choice, among others. John has developed and authored several pieces of legislation, including the landmark Right to Earn a Living Act and the Arizona law that is a topic of today's discussion. His work at the Institute has been covered by national media, including The Wall Street Journal, CBS This Morning, Bloomberg News, and Politico. Prior to joining the Goldwater Institute, John served on active duty in the U.S. Navy Judge Advocate General's JAG Corps. He also previously clerked for Senator John Kyle on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, worked for the Rules Committee in the Arizona State Senate, and clerked in the Office of Counsel to the President at the White House. Finally, I'm pleased to say that John also serves as member of the RTP State and Local Regulation Working Group. If you'd like to learn more about either of our guests, please visit recproject.org. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Our guests will take questions after their remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have for them prior to the start of the question and answer period. Okay, thank you, John and Philip, for participating in today's Free Lunch Podcast. I'll now turn the floor over to you, John, to get us started. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Devin, and thanks for that introduction. Thank you also to Professor Hamburger. I'm honored to be talking about this important topic with a person who has had more influence on it than perhaps anyone else in the country. And to all of our listeners, happy Law Day. It is a fortuitous state of events that we're discussing this important topic on a day that recognizes the importance of law in our structural constitution. I'd like to start out for a moment with a thought exercise. Imagine for a moment if an attorney from another country told you that their system worked as follows. Agencies within the executive branch of that country, independent of the legislature, made laws through a rulemaking process. Sometimes they received public input. Sometimes that rulemaking process followed a formal format. Other times it didn't. Other times the executive agencies just put out substantive policy statements or letters of interpretation or the like. And of course, all of those actions have the force of law. If there were to be an alleged violation of one of those rules or regulations, the same agency that made the rule would investigate the alleged violation. Then the same agency would hire an administrative judge to adjudicate any of those alleged violations. Now, in many parts of that country, if the department head or the head of the agency didn't like what the administrative law judge found, he or she would be free to ignore those findings. Now, fortunately, this country has an independent judiciary. But when it comes to reviewing decisions from executive agencies, the judiciary is forced to ignore its own view of the law and instead defer to the department's interpretation of disputed legal questions. And the court would also defer to the agency or the department's interpretation of its own rules that have the force of law. I think if someone were to describe that system to you, you would assume, perhaps rightly, that neither due process of law nor separation of powers existed in a strong or meaningful way. As most people on this call are probably aware, this imaginary country happens to be the present-day United States. And this describes our system of administrative law and Chevron in our deference. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we live in a system where unelected regulators at administrative agencies are lawmaker, sheriff, judge, and jury. And if agency decisions are challenged in court, the law requires the court to side with the agency, and in all but the most extraordinary circumstances, the agency's actions will be upheld. This state of affairs is the result of the Supreme Court's 1984 decision, or at least in large part is the result of the Supreme Court's decision in Chevron USA, Inc., the Natural Resources Defense Council. In that case, the court determined that administrative agencies are given a legal advantage in court proceedings that no other party enjoys. And because of this legal advantage, because of what is called Chevron deference, if you are a regulated person in an administrative agency says you violated Statute X, and you say, I believe Statute X means A, but the agency says, I believe Statute X means B, the court is obligated to side with the agency on that disputed question of law. And, of course, administrative agencies in this country exercise extraordinary power. Under existing law, administrative agencies are free to fine people, deny them licenses, and even recommend criminal penalties for alleged violations of agency rules and regulations. So why is this a problem, or is it? I would posit that this is a problem for really two main reasons. There's a practical problem, and then there is a structural problem. The practical problem with deference is a problem of accountability. Regulators know that they can create expansive rules. They know that they can investigate borderline violations, and they know they can adjudicate close cases in their own favor. They know that because if they're challenged, in most circumstances, they'll win in that challenge. And the result is more rulemaking. The result is more investigations and more findings of violations of rules and regulations. And at bottom, that results in bigger, more invasive government, at least with respect to the administrative state. On the other hand, when there is accountability, The result is more sensible rulemaking and more sensible enforcement actions. I'm going to give you a quick example in another context because I think it demonstrates the point. As some of the callers might be aware, in economic cases, cases involving, for example, somebody who wants to start a new business or receive a job license, if those regulatory decisions are challenged in court, they're reviewed under the lowest standard of judicial scrutiny, what's called rational basis. So while other cases, such as free speech cases and the like, receive strict scrutiny that requires the government to justify any restrictions on liberty, economic regulations and laws are essentially all but rubber stamped by the judiciary. So in the context of occupational licensing, this field where the government mandates that somebody receive a license before working in the job of their choice, we looked at that at the organization for which I work, at the Goldwater Institute, and we developed a law that simply elevated the standard of review from rational basis to something that looks a lot more like intermediate scrutiny. Now, at the time we developed this measure and were advocating for its passage, we faced some scrutiny from people who argued that this would result in the typical floodgate of litigation argument. We responded that rather than seeing more litigation, this measure would in fact result in less regulation or at least more sensible regulation, because it would inject a needed measure of accountability into a system where it didn't exist before. Now that this has been law for over a year and we have the benefit of hindsight, we've actually seen exactly this happen. That is, more sensible regulatory decision making and less arbitrary regulation. We had an interesting case involving a woman named Annette Stanley, who was a licensed behavioral health counselor. And she had received her license in Kansas, where after completing her master's degree, she completed more than 2,000 hours of supervised work. In Kansas, she received her supervised work under the auspices of a PhD counselor who had been practicing in the field for over 20 years. And she was fully licensed in Kansas after she received this supervision. Now, her husband received a job offer out in Arizona, and so the family moved out here to accept that offer. When Annette tried to transfer her license, the licensing board, the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health, denied her request, claiming that none of the thousands of hours of supervised work counted in Arizona because she had operated in an independent setting where her and her supervisor owned their own practice. And Arizona had a rule that forbade having an ownership interest in a firm where a licensee was also receiving supervised work experience. So we intervened, arguing that the rule did not survive this new heightened scrutiny of Arizona's occupational licensing law. Rather than face litigation, the board, within a matter of weeks, met twice and decided to change their rule to eliminate the ownership requirement and to grant Annette her license. In other words, because there was accountability, they engaged in more sensible decision making. And in the absence of that accountability, they would have continued to enforce this rule against Annette, who incidentally would still be out of a job, but is now working successfully in an independent practice, and the rule would still be in place to be enforced against others like her. It is, it's my view that where Chevron is eliminated, there will be this same effect. Now, supporters of deference have said, well, these rules would exist anyway, and violations would occur anyway, which is true. So isn't this just a matter of who decides? Yes, it is a matter of who decides. But who decides determines almost everything. As a very simple example, a silly example almost, imagine if parents promulgated a rule in their family that required their teenage child to return home on the weekend, quote, at a reasonable hour. What's reasonable to a 16-year-old is not going to be the same thing that is reasonable to two middle-aged parents. And when an agency gets to decide what a vague statute means, the agency will always decide in its own favor. And of course, if this is a rule rather than a statute, the agency gets to determine what was reasonable in the first instance. This leads to my second point, that this creates a structural problem. It is, of course, for the legislature, for Congress, and not the executive to write the laws. For too long, Congress has been writing vague or broad laws and then leaving it to administrative agencies to fill in the details. Agencies then write rules and, of course, interpret those rules how they see fit, which effectively turns administrative agencies into super legislatures and its own judiciary. I'll give one more quick example, because I think it helps illustrate this point. This happened in a case that the Goldwater Institute litigated against the Federal Aviation Administration. We represented a company called FlightNow, and FlightNow created a digital platform that allowed pilots of small aircraft to communicate their flight plans to potential passengers in order to share the cost of the flight. Now, as it happens, pilots and passengers have been doing this since the beginning of general aviation for well over 60 years. And the way pilots and passengers would connect with each other was through whatever means of communication happened to be available to them, whether that was email, telephone, posting their flight plans on local airport bulletin boards. Now, the company we represented, FlightNow, a small startup, simply applied this framework to the digital age by allowing pilots to post flight information on the internet rather than on, for example, a physical bulletin board at the airport. This act of using the internet to communicate, however, ran afoul of FAA's own judgment. The FAA determined that private pilots of these aircraft were instead common carriers that were subject to the same regulations and rules that are applicable to Delta and American Airlines pilots. Now, this is important because Congress had never defined the term common carrier in the context of general aviation. And because there was a vacuum there, the FAA defined it in the 1980s, and that definition hasn't been updated since. The FAA then twisted its own definition, its own rule of common carrier, so that FlightNow's operations would fall under it. And then they issued an order that effectively shut down the FlightNow website and the pilots who communicated on it. When FlightNow challenged the FAA's interpretation of its own rule, the court sided with the agency's interpretation because of our deference, because of this requirement that courts defer to an agency's interpretation of its own rules. I give you that example because what happened after this case is, I think, what should happen in these instances, and I think what would be more likely to happen in the event that Chevron and our deference is eliminated. Following this case, Congressman Mark Sanford and then now Senator Mike Lee introduced legislation that would statutorily define common carrier. But I would say it should not take a court case for Congress to do its job in the first instance. And I think in the absence of Chevron and our deference, regulators would be a little more constrained in their rulemaking, and they would limit those rules to those that are more specifically authorized by statute. And I think they would also be more measured in their interpretations. This would necessarily encourage Congress to act in instances where it has failed to do so, which I believe would help restore the proper separation of powers. So looking at those two problems, in Arizona, we crafted what I think is a relatively simple solution. We went into Arizona's Administrative Procedures Act, which incidentally is based on the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, and we amended the language to eliminate deference to agency decisions. That language now looks like this. It says, quote, "In a proceeding brought by or against the regulated party, the court shall decide all questions of law, including the interpretation of a constitutional or statutory provision or a rule adopted by an agency without deference to any previous determination that may have been made on the question by the agency." So in other words, the statute addressed both Chevron deference, when a statute is vague and an agency interprets it, and our deference, when an agency interprets its own rules. Why start with the states? By our count, 36 states have either expressly adopted Chevron or cited it approvingly. So this is a important state-based reform in its own right. And also, because many states base their state administrative procedures code on the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, we believe this law can serve as a model for federal reform. And in fact, different versions of bills to eliminate Chevron deference have been introduced and passed out of the U.S. House previously, but not out of both chambers. So I'll conclude by saying administrative deference, in our view, is offensive to both due process of law and the proper separation of powers in our Republican government. As a result of Arizona's reform, Arizonans now have an equal and fair opportunity to challenge regulatory actions without having to contend with a court case that favors the government party over them or over the private party. The result of this statute, we are hopeful, will be not only appropriate due process in the administrative context, but a law that injects needed accountability into a system where it is currently absent, which will have the effect of resulting in better regulatory decision-making. Of course, we're hopeful that Arizona's law will serve as a model for the 36 other states that have adopted Chevron or relied on it, as well as for the federal government. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Professor Hamburger.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here. And thanks, Jonathan, for your account of all of this. My congratulations to the Goldwater Institute for getting this law through in Arizona. I think that's a great start, and we just have to keep on pushing it. So these statutes at the state level, I think, are very important. They contribute not only to getting justice in particular states, but also to delegitimizing Chevron and Auer and all the deference doctrines that threaten us in so many ways. So this is important both in a narrow sense and also in a broader sense in trying to shift ideas about this topic. Now, unfortunately, I confess I don't have great confidence in legislators. Some of them do well, as in Arizona, but I think there are many states where we won't see this result. And unfortunately, Congress has not gone in this direction. The Separation of Powers Act was passed by the House, but not by the Senate, and I'm not going to hold my breath for them to take a position on this. So that leads to something, something that I want to talk about here, which is litigation and the litigation paths we can take against Chevron and Auer. This is something I've been talking about since 2014 when I wrote my Chevron bias piece. It went up on SSRN then and then later got published. And I want to lay out some of the arguments there because I think these are arguments that litigators can use in any number of cases. There are always hundreds of Chevron or Chevron-like cases sitting out there in the district courts and even more in the state courts. And in any one of these cases, there are opportunities to make arguments to help one's client, and more generally, to spare us the dangers of Chevron. So what's wrong with Chevron as a constitutional matter? Well, the standard arguments against this are separation of powers, and indeed it is a separation of powers problem. It's also a federalism problem. But there's yet another aspect of this I'd like to emphasize, which I think until recently people hadn't paid sufficient attention to. That is, what happens in court when judges follow Chevron? And the answer, of course, is they abandon their independent judgment. They have a duty, it's the very nature of their office, to exercise judgment. And that means they judge what the law requires or what a rule requires, if that's to be treated as law. And the net effect of Chevron is to lead judges astray, to lead them to rely on somebody else's judgment. And this is a gross dereliction of duty. But there's a second problem, which is even more serious and more concrete, which is when the government is a party to one of these proceedings and the judges follow Chevron, what effectively they're doing is announcing that they have a pre-commitment in favor of one of the parties, in favor of the most powerful of party, and against ordinary Americans. What it means is that the judges are systematically biased against us and in favor of the government whenever the government's a party and Chevron comes into question. And this judicial bias, I think, is a profound due process problem. Imagine that judges announced, or that the Supreme Court required judges to announce, that they would always favor, let's say, the corporation and the labor or business owner in a labor dispute. This would be grossly unconstitutional. It would lead to impeachment. I don't see how this is really very different. Now, I'm not arguing for impeachment of judges here, just that they recant on what is surely one of their grossest abnegations of duty and grossest violations of due process. Now, how are they to do this? It comes up in a number of ways. For one thing, judges need to distinguish between their judgment or order in a case and their opinion. It's perfectly reasonable for a judge, in fact, it's appropriate for a judge to follow precedent and at the same time criticize it. To say the Supreme Court requires me to defer and this is a violation of due process, I'm torn by this, although I follow Supreme Court rule. In my opinion, I want to express how awful it is and that the justices should recant. It's also, I think, perfectly reasonable for a district or a circuit court judge to say that they're not going to follow Chevron, because it's unconstitutional. Now, they may be slapped down, but actually that's not so clear because the Supreme Court itself is changing on this. It's not just Justice Thomas. Just last week, Justice Breyer reminded people of his view, which is that, well, Chevron is in a sense is optional. It's a reminder of certain respect to be paid to agencies, but it isn't really binding on lower court judges. So I don't have his exact words in front of me, but you can Google it yourself. And the result is that I think there really is room for a correction of error, not only the usual correction of error, which the Supreme Court corrects lower courts, but that lower court judges can correct the error of the Supreme Court, which is something lower courts regularly do, and they can do it here. Now, there's another avenue here, and if any of you listeners are government lawyers, it's something you should pay attention to. Remember, when a government lawyer comes into court and asks the court to apply Chevron, in a case in which the government is a party, of course, what is that lawyer asking the judge to do? The lawyer is asking the judge to be biased in favor of the government's legal position. That's a little awkward. At the very least, that's a violation of ethical duties to ask a judge to violate due process, and perhaps it is itself a violation of due process. So I think government lawyers need to be very careful about this. Fortunately, the Justice Department has begun to recognize this. The Justice Department earlier this year issued the second of two memos, the gist of which is that Justice Department will not allow Justice Department lawyers to defend guidance from agencies, from federal agencies. And although this memo didn't really go far enough, it wasn't based on constitutional grounds. It didn't really create a pathway for forcing agencies to acknowledge this. It's the beginning of an acknowledgement by the Justice Department that there's a real problem in having government lawyers ask for deference. And that should be a model, I think, for state AGs to reconsider all deference and whether or not they have their lawyers pursue it in court, and should be a reminder to all government lawyers about the risks to them personally in seeking deference. There's something deeply unethical about this. And I think that has to be put squarely on the table. Now, all of this has a certain technical aspect to it. When we're talking about a case and its several steps, going in a doctrine by the name of Chevron, but there are larger ideals here. And some of these ideals, we all know, those are the ideals of the Constitution, of due process. But there are also ideals here of the administrative state. Suppose one wants an administrative state. It's not my view, obviously, but if we actually want an administrative state, I would suggest it's probably important for you to stick to your ideals. And the ideals of the administrative state were that there should be clarity, that rulemaking should be authorized expressly by Congress, that there should be judicial review that is unbiased. So if you want to live up to your administrative ideals, I think one has to abandon Chevron and all deference. I will close my comments by just saying that I actually think the Goldwater Institute's efforts here are very encouraging. It shows that states can reform themselves, and perhaps that should give us hope for Congress. I also am very encouraged by the fact that it's only taken a few years to bring Chevron into question. I wrote my piece against Chevron in 2014. It gets published in 2000, circulated manuscripts, published in 2016. And here we are in 2018, and Chevron, if not quite dead, is tottering it by the grave. And that means that the entire administrative state is open to question. We should have confidence in our arguments based on civil liberties and should pursue them. I'll close by simply saying because so much is at stake, I decided recently to step out of my merely academic role and start the New Civil Liberties Alliance, a litigation group designed to litigate for civil liberties against the administrative state, to recognize it as a civil liberties issue which needs a civil liberties movement. And it's called an alliance because we look forward to working with other groups that are interested in this, including the Goldwater Institute. So this is all very gratifying, and we look forward to litigating these cases, and I encourage everybody to join the movement in favor of civil liberties and against the administrative state. Thank you.
Thank you, John and Philip, for your initial remarks. I think now we'll go ahead and open up the floor to questions. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor and ask a question of either one of our guests, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. I'm going to open the floor now. Okay, the floor is on, is open. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. We're going to answer all those questions in the order in which they're received. Again, if you have a request, or you have a question, you can request the floor by entering star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We have quite a few questions already, but I'd like to make a quick announcement since I have everyone's ear, and that is that the Phoenix chapter of the Federalist Society, the Phoenix Lawyers chapters of the Federalist Society, is going to have an event tomorrow, Wednesday, May 2nd, from 6 o'clock p.m. to 8 o'clock p.m., that's Mountain Time, on this particular topic. The title for the event is called The Death of Chevron. It's a discussion regarding the future of Chevron deference and how the regulatory state could change based on the law that is the topic of today's discussion. It'll feature Tom Collins, Executive Director, the Arizona Clean Elections Commission, William Eskridge, Jr., John A. Garver, Professor of Jurisprudence, Yale Law School, and the Honorable Patricia Starr, Lower Court of Appeals, Maricopa County Superior Court Judge. Be moderated by Dominic Dre, Arizona Solicitor General. Again, that is tomorrow in Phoenix, Arizona, the Newton, 300 West Camelback Road, Phoenix, Arizona, from 6 o'clock p.m. to 8 o'clock p.m. I do believe registration for that event ends tomorrow at noon, so please register if you plan to attend. Okay, we'll go to audience questions. Caller, when we get to your request, you can ask your question.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for a very informative and interesting conversation. This is Gregory Dolan from University of Baltimore. And I have a question ultimately about, whether we are, whether a sort of Chevron fight is a preview or really is it kind of the ultimate sort of big enchilada? Because as I think was alluded to in the conversation, it seems that ultimately the question is not so much whether agencies are deferred to, but how much power do agencies have to set binding rules in the first place? And in part because what I find both exhilarating and potential, but also potentially scary about abandoning Chevron is that it's exactly right. Who decides makes all the difference. And depending on what kind of a judge you get, you may, just as you might get decisions that will increase individual liberty, you might as well get decisions that order agencies to do more regulation, not based on what they already are doing, but based on judges' view of what the law, or what the progressive reading of the law requires. So I just wonder whether ultimately it all collapses into non-delegation as opposed to really the level of deference due.
Thank you, Greg.
Well, this is Philip. I think it's very reasonable to worry about what happens after Chevron, and I confess I'm not quite so concerned, but that's because I think judges should not be interpreting statutes that are so vague that they do not really give much guidance to the judges as to what to do. At that point, the judges should just stop. There's nothing there. It's not that they should hold the statute unconstitutional where it's so vague that even ordinary canons of interpretation cannot help, but rather that they should find that there's no meaning there. This is a perfectly traditional thing to do, and it's very reasonable. It keeps them out of trouble so that they don't start making policy. And I would hope that it avoids the sort of problem you describe. There'd be a difficult transition perhaps for a few years, but I think Congress would very quickly get the hint that if they want something done, they should just enact it. And of course, getting rid of Chevron does not get rid of the possibility that Congress can expressly authorize rulemaking. So Congress could easily respond by simply expressly authorizing rulemaking. That's not really asking too much. It doesn't ask them to do anything substantive.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I was gonna echo the thoughts that the decision would then be made by the party that should be making the decisions in the first instance, Congress. And to the extent Congress did pass a statute that was disputable, again, I think the court shouldn't be in the business of giving preference to one party over the other.
Can I get to another point that the questioner raised? What is the fight over Chevron? Is it just an appetizer or just foreplay? And I think in a sense it is, and the defenders of the administrative state should not be too concerned. Congress can still adopt a statute authorizing rulemaking, and that's the larger question. And none of that will be resolved merely by getting rid of Chevron. So this is a beginning, but it's just a beginning.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll go to our next question now. Caller, when we get to you, you can ask your question.
Yeah, this is Mike Doherty. I'm the CEO of LabMD, in quite a large battle with the Federal Trade Commission, and we've been dancing around Chevron at the 11th Circuit and still waiting about a year for the ruling. But my question really is that, to me, I always talk about this as the long step up Justice Mountain, and that Chevron is used, just like the administrative state is used, is to pound you down and hold you at the ankle so you don't get to an Article III judge. And then Chevron cuts the heart out of the Article III judge so that we don't have due process. But outside of the legal profession, trust me, as I have 30 years in healthcare and only became expert on this when the tree fell down on me, people still don't know this. I think this is the symptomatic part of what people talk to now. They call it the swamp. And I'm curious as to what the gentlemen that are speaking on this call today, which is a great call, talk about how, especially in Arizona, they deal with the business community, anyone that's not a lawyer, because I find most of those people are just bewildered at best about what really the structure is. No one really understands it till it hits them in the face.
Yeah, that's two great points. I think what you have now is the regulated community, people subject to the administrative state, already are very hesitant to challenge it, either because they don't know, or if they're like you, because they know, and they know that if they challenge regulatory decisions, they're going to lose. So that creates, I think, an additional layer of problems that's frankly the result of Chevron, where you have a bunch of people simply capitulating to the government decision-making without ever trying to challenge it. And frankly, that's a rational choice, because they know if they challenge it, they're probably not going to win. So I think that a lot of that can be corrected to the extent that once some of these challenges are brought and won, there will continue to be a reevaluation at the agency itself, but then perhaps the regulated community becomes more aware, discusses it among other industries, other actors within the regulated community, and they become more aware of their new rights. And that's the hope. And then, of course, there's just a general public education piece that goes along with that. But I think a lot of it is going to be the result of litigation and successful litigation early on that then becomes publicly known.
Yeah, I would love to see someone send me a civics book that actually talks about this to students in high school, that explains it in an objective manner. I'm still waiting.
I didn't get that book in law school.
Exactly.
Right.
You guys need to get busy writing one.
Right.
Just buy Phillips' book.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the caller very correctly identifies one of the problems, which is for 100-plus years, folks have talked about this problem simply in a generic terms as too much regulation, as if it's legitimate to have some of this but not more, and as if it's really about the substance of the rules. And what's at stake here is how the rules are made and who enforces them. And so we need to talk about this in terms that recognize those legal aspects and that do it in ways people understand. And that's why I think this really has to be understood as a civil liberties movement. One of the goals of the New Civil Liberties Alliance is precisely to get all Americans to recognize that they have a stake in this. And what's more, we want people to understand that this is not just something you have to litigate once and then again and then again and then again. On the contrary, one has to view it as a systemic threat that cuts across agencies and address it as a systemic threat so that one brings a few cases that take down all of Chevron deference. And this is only going to happen if, as I tell my students, we recognize that you can't expect someone else to stand up for your rights unless you stand up for somebody else's. And so, because the danger is the administrative state will pick a certain industry, you know, coal, healthcare, go after it, and everybody else just steps aside because they don't want to get hurt. But instead, we have to recognize that we all have an interest in our civil liberties against the sort of due process problem. And then when one chooses the right case, everybody should join in to help win that case so you don't have to fight it yourself.
Thank you, Philip and John. Thank you, Mike, for the question. We'll move on to our next question now.
Hi, my name is Larry Joseph. I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm wondering if or how this exports. I haven't looked at the whole Arizona APA, so I assume somewhere near the top there's something that says this applies to actions in state court. But the actual language that was added doesn't limit it to state court. And, I mean, I guess there could be a diversity case where state law, different states law applied, but it was in Arizona court. I'm not sure that I care about that. But what I'm really thinking about is, as a civil rights issue, 42 U.S.C. 1988A, which basically says you can import statutory and common law from states into a federal civil rights action. There's a bunch of criteria for when you can do it. This is, by the way, what's used, for example, to import statutes of limitations into a civil rights claim. There's no federal statute of limitations, so you look to state law. This would be the same kind of thing, although it's substantive or quasi-substantive. Anyway, the question is, the language from 1988A is, so far as the same, the state law, is not inconsistent with the Constitution or laws of the United States. Now, most of the people on this call agree that Chevron's inconsistent, but could you put on your Chevron hat, or your pro-Chevron hat, and say whether using this state law in a federal case would be not inconsistent with the laws, with the Constitution and laws of the United States?
That's a really interesting question that, in candor, I haven't thought deeply on. The way the amendment was done was to go into Title 32 in Arizona, which is where the Administrative Procedures Act exists, with the idea that only agency decisions and regulations that are subject to the APA are appealed for review in a traditional court. So, I think that argument can be made along the lines that you are making, because it does not conflict with the Constitution, or federal law. I just think a federal court would be very reluctant to, read a state statute as one that could override the existing state of the precedent. I don't know if Professor Hamburger has additional thoughts on that.
It's a very interesting question. Yes, I think we would agree it's not inconsistent with the law, with the Constitution and laws of the United States. On the other hand, to the extent that one understands Chevron as really interpreting what particular ambiguous statutes require, why then perhaps it is inconsistent. So the position one would have to take is that Chevron is a somewhat freestanding presumption that is not attached simply to particular statutes or interpretations of particular statutes. But of course, that's open to debate, and it would be fun to debate, wouldn't it?
Thanks.
Thank you for the question, and thanks for the responses, fellas. We'll go on to our next question now. Caller, when we get to you, you'll hear a prompt, and you can ask your question.
Hello, Laura Peterson in Washington. Professor Hamburger, I believe you had suggested or indicated that some Justice Department, U.S. Justice Department attorneys had indicated some reluctance or possible reluctance or broadcast their reluctance to argue Chevron or our deference. Would you kindly elaborate on that?
So there were two memos, if I remember correctly, authored by Rachel Brand before she left the Justice Department, which cumulatively took the position that Justice Department lawyers should not be defending guidance, even guidance. The first memo was specified Justice Department guidance, the second one, any guidance from any agency. Now, this is just a small step. It merely limits what Justice Department lawyers are meant to do. It's merely as to guidance, so it is not. it doesn't fully get rid of our and certainly not Chevron. It's not based on constitutional arguments. It wasn't itself adopted as a rule. It's just an internal memo. So it's just a little hint, but it's a reminder that that concerns about deference doctrines are circulating through the Justice Department, and there's some concern about what government lawyers can appropriately do. I think the Justice Department ought to go much further. I think it would not be unreasonable for, in fact, it would be desirable for the Attorney General to issue opinion that any pursuit of guidance by a government lawyer in court, where the government's a party to a case, is a violation of the ethics of the lawyer and participation in due process, in as much as one's asking the court to favor the legal position of one party over the other, merely on account of the status of the party. So what we've seen is just a first step, but it is it's a very, very encouraging first step. It's a reminder that change is on the way.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go on to our next question now. Caller, when we get to you, you can ask your question.
Hi, this is Corey Liu from Houston, Texas. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what efforts are being done to sort of study state administrative issues. I mean, I think we've heard a lot about the federal issues, but I'm curious, you know, what are some good books, articles, websites, groups that are sort of focusing on these issues like state Chevron deference and, you know, what sort of issues are going on at state agencies?
I'll take a first crack at that one with the response that not much. When the Goldwater Institute first started exploring deference at the state level, we had to do a lot of original research to see the extent to which it existed, which we have. I encourage you to visit our own website, goldwaterinstitute.org. We will be putting out some subsequent research and possibly papers on this issue going forward. Mercatus Center has done some work along these lines, and I know that they have a state-based project that is currently continuing that explores some of these questions. Frankly, most of the research has been done at the federal level, to my knowledge.
Yes, I quite agree. When I started paying attention to the state level and talking to folks at the state level several years ago, I was astonished at how difficult it was even to understand the doctrines in particular states. In some states, in fact, it's by no means clear what judicial doctrine is. So there's a lot of work yet to be done. And it's a great opportunity, too, to start unraveling Chevron to work through the states.
Wonderful. Thank you for the question, and thanks for the responses. I actually have a question here I'd like to pose, which I think dovetails nicely with the previous question. Before I get to my question, though, I'd like to ask the audience one last time, since we're getting pretty close to the end of our call, to buzz in if you have any questions for our guests. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, you enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll try to get to you before the end of our program. Gentlemen, Arizona is not the only state undertaking efforts to reform its courts such that Chevron-like deference is not employed. However, consistent with states being laboratories for experimentation, at least one state, the state of Florida, instead of passing a law, its Constitution Revision Commission, which I believe is put together every 10 years or so, has developed and is advancing a constitutional amendment, which will face a November referendum to eliminate Chevron-like deference in its state courts. I wonder if either of you have any thoughts on the different procedure that Florida is undergoing to eliminate Chevron-like deference in its courts, its difference between the Arizona law and a constitutional amendment. Florida, obviously, the constitutional amendment is presumably more permanent than the Arizona solution. But do you have any thoughts about this?
Well, this is Philip. I think we know all too well from our federal constitution, the constitutions are not that permanent. And different states will, of course, have different political circumstances. And so any way that works. Obviously, constitutional concerns underlie the admirable Arizona effort. And if it's going to be in a constitution, so much the better in Florida. I think it's very important what's happening in Florida and should be encouraged.
I agree entirely. Whatever method will achieve the objective, and I think it's perfectly permissible to do this constitutionally, it is a constitutional issue at bottom. The reason it was done statutorily in Arizona is because, for a variety of reasons, but the Chevron was adopted here based on the court's reading of Arizona's Administrative Procedures Act, so it seemed reasonable to propose amendments to that specific statute, and many states exist like that. But all that said, to the extent it is possible to get constitutional solutions, all the better.
Very good. Thanks for humoring me. And that's given us enough time to get our final question queued up here. So we'll go to that question, but I want to put both of our speakers on notice that I'll ask for final remarks after answering this question. So if you'd like to be thinking about that in the meantime, please do so. Caller, when we get to you, you can ask your question.
Hi, John Peabody from Northern Virginia. Joined the call late, so forgive me if this has been asked, but as the argument has been made to me that as a practical matter, the Congress just is not going to get into all the kinds of details that regulatory requirements of the modern state, get to, and that Chevron basically allows deference to the executive branch as a co-equal of the Congress to implement the rules and regulations. So how would, in the absence of Chevron, how would this practical reality be addressed? Thanks.
My response, I think it's a very good, sensible question, and my response to that sort of concern is simply to ask, if you have a small child, how do you teach your child to tie his or her shoes? If you always tie your child's shoes, the child will never learn. If after showing the child how to do it, you don't tie the shoes, and then the child will begin to have an incentive to do it themselves. And I take the same attitude towards Congress. If you don't tie its shoes, it will have to do it itself. And goodness gracious, it's filled with lots of very smart people. I think they'll figure it out.
And I would echo that. And you see it in instances where agencies, for lack of a better word, mess up or create a splash with either their rules, regulations, or their interpretation of those. Congress will get involved, and I think that there should be more instances in which Congress is incentivized to do so.
Fantastic. Wonderful questions all throughout the question and answer period. Thank you, everyone, for participating at this time. I'd like to just ask Philip and John if you have any closing remarks or any final thoughts that you haven't shared already with our audience before we close.
Devin, I'll just say briefly, look, the result of this doctrine has been legislative abdication, it's been judicial abdication, and it shouldn't seem like a major controversial step to simply say that when these disputes arise, they should be moderated by an independent, impartial party. That should be a very modest reform. But with that modest reform, I think, come very significant consequences. One is you get better decisions, and then you also get the decision maker being the right party in the first instance. So I think a sensible, modest reform like this can have very important ramifications across our administrative system.
I'll simply add that I think we should all take great pleasure in the Arizona decision. It's very encouraging. Chevron is profoundly unconstitutional. It corrupts the judges in their judgment because they relinquish their judgment, abandon the very office of independent judgment. It's a violation of due process for the government's a party because they are biased in favor of one party's legal position. It corrupts government lawyers who ask for Chevron deference because then they're participating in the due process violation. And even if one likes the administrative state, one should want to get rid of Chevron, because, of course, the primary justification for the administrative state has been that, well, at least you get judicial review, fair, impartial judicial review. But if Chevron stands in the way of fair, impartial judicial review, then if you want to defend the administrative state, you should gladly relinquish Chevron. I'll just add that if any of you in the audience encounter any lower court Chevron or our cases where you think an intervention would be useful or amusing, please don't hesitate to contact me. The New Civil Liberties Alliance is interested in litigating Chevron in the lower federal courts and in state courts, so be glad to hear from you. Thank you.
Thank you again, gentlemen. I want to also repeat that the New Civil Liberties Alliance has a website at nclalegal.org where you can share those thoughts that you might have with Professor Hamburger and his team at the New Civil Liberties Alliance. On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, I want to thank you all for joining us today. And, of course, once again, thank Philip and John for joining us as Free Lunch Podcast guests. Until we meet again, take care, everyone, and goodbye.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers, and you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.